accountable up to the governor. And then how you move ahead with dealing with this crisis today. I mean, talking about the lead poisoning of the children of Flint, a majority black city, what this means for the future. And ultimately, you've called this actually a crisis of democracy because Snyder empowered unelected town managers that he put in place in mainly black cities of Michigan to run your city and others.
Yes. Well, you know, like when the Supreme Court like voided like those indictments, it was really like a slap in the face. It just really felt like, you know, like, when are we going to actually receive justice? And in the eyes of many Flint residents, justice for them isn't getting their lead service line replaced, or, you know, today is actually the last day for residents to fill out their paperwork to be part of the civil lawsuit. It's not that. It's actually seeing someone convicted and going to jail for poisoning 100,000 Flint residents. And then also, unfortunately, you know, the systems that created Michigan's emergency manager law is still on the books, and they're actually looking to tweak it because—
Mayor, we have 15 seconds.
Okay, it's going under financial distress. So this is something that is going to be ongoing, and we have to continue to fight in the streets for justice that we deserve.
And we will continue to follow this, as we did with the documentary Thirsty for Democracy, The Poisoning of an American City. You can go to it online at democracynow.org. Nayara Sharif, director of Flint Rising, and Melissa Mays, resident of Flint and organizer with Flint Rising. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Isis Phillips. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Saturday in the Park, Vancouver, USA Pride, on Saturday, July 9th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Esther Short Park in Vancouver. This LGBTQ plus Pride celebration includes games, drag queen story hour, education workshops, and more. That's Saturday in the Park, Vancouver, USA Pride, on Saturday, July 9th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Esther Short Park, 400 West 6th Street in Vancouver. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the second Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, 9/11 survivors and family members come to Portland protesting a Saudi-funded golf tournament. Portland Fire is itself under fire after a city auditor calls its accountability system incoherent. And one West Coast state moves a step closer to universal health care. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 30th, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. A golf tournament sponsored by the government of Saudi Arabia is in Portland this afternoon, and met with fierce protests. A group of 9/11 survivors and family members traveled to Portland to let people know why they're opposed to golfers participating in the tournament at Pumpkin Ridge, the first U.S.-based event for LIB Golf. Here's what one of the protesters said about Saudi Arabia's human rights record and role in the worst terrorist attack on American soil.
Thank you again for having us. My name is Tim Froelich. I was a severely injured survivor in the attack on 9/11. I worked in the South Tower on the 80th floor. I was fortunate to escape with my life. Unfortunately, I was injured in collapse of that building. My reason for speaking to you today is many reasons, really. But first, I want to talk about what's really going on here. This event is nothing more than a group of very talented athletes who appear to have turned their backs on the crime of murder. They apparently do not care and do not understand that 3,000 family members were wiped out and killed on that day 21 years ago. And to this day, we still have members, rescue workers dying from health-related issues as a result of 9/11. These golfers, 9/11 families at this point in time are not asking for empathy. We're not asking for people to stand up and say, well, we'll offer you that and we'll offer you prayers. What we're asking for is some form of justice. And I ask that you all please log on to 911justice.org and read the documents. Our own FBI has finally stepped up with the help of the Biden administration and offered us these documents that clearly implicate the Saudis and the murder of what happened almost 21 years ago. Justice can also be found in the truth. And in those documents that are now out there, the truth is there. That is our own FBI saying, this is what they did, and this is how they plotted, and this is how they murdered many thousands of people. As the United States of America approaches the celebration of Independence Day this weekend, my question to these golfers is, do any of you have the guts to be independent thinkers, to stand up and look at exactly what you're doing in taking blood money and sports washing as a result of the murder of 3,000 people 21 years ago? Let's be independent thinkers. You've been bought off. You've made a decision. Now at least sit with us, meet with us, talk to us about what the facts and what has happened here in the last 21 years. Again, I want to thank you. Thank you all for coming, and thank you for your support.
Others objecting include Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley, who called out the Saudi Arabian government, saying they cannot be allowed to cover up an egregious human rights record, including the murder of journalists like Jamal Khashoggi, with a flashy golf tour. Independent candidate for Oregon Governor Betsy Johnson is getting some pushback for calling Portland the city of roaches. In recent media interviews, Johnson has criticized what she calls the deterioration of Portland. In one of her TV ads, she appears driving around criticizing homeless camps. The former state senator has raised more money from corporate donors than her Democratic opponent, Tina Kotek, and the Republican candidate, Christine Drazen. One of Johnson's donors is Nike founder Phil Knight, who has given her campaign more than $1 million. With the January 6th hearings revealing more about former President Donald Trump, how are Americans reacting? KBOO's Josh Salem has more on what some new polling shows.
A new poll shows about half of America believes former President Donald Trump should be criminally charged for his role in the U.S. Capitol insurrection. An Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs survey found 48% of U.S. adults say the ex-president should be charged, while 31% say he should not. 20% don't know enough to have an opinion. The poll was conducted after five public hearings from the House committee investigating the January 6th attack had already taken place. It was taken before Tuesday's surprise hearing featuring former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson. Some experts say her testimony provides the strongest evidence to date that Trump may have committed a federal crime. Views break down along party lines, with 86% of Democrats but only 10% of Republicans saying Trump should be charged. Some Americans believe other Republicans in Congress were significantly responsible for the events of January 6th. 46% hold that view. The 9-member House panel, composed of 7 Democrats and 2 Republicans, has been working for about a year to investigate the potential connection between Trump and his allies in a Capitol insurrection. 75% of Democrats and 42% of Republicans have followed their hearings. While the committee can investigate and issue subpoenas to gather information, only the Justice Department can bring criminal charges. There is evidence the Justice Department is interested. Federal agents seized the cell phone of Trump lawyer John Eastman yesterday. Eastman was allegedly behind a plan to pressure then Vice President Mike Pence into rejecting the Electoral College results. Authorities searched the home of Jeffrey Clark, who championed Trump's false claims of election fraud. Agents also served subpoenas to the Republican Party chairpersons of Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia, 3 states where Trump allies created slates of so-called alternate electors intended to subvert the vote. The poll of 1,053 adults was conducted between June 23rd and June 27th. The margin of sampling error was plus or minus 4 percentage points. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A new city audit finds that Portland's Fire Bureau is lacking both accountability and diversity. The new report from the city auditor's office calls the Fire Bureau's accountability system incoherent and says anti-discrimination trainings are skipped and managers are giving out inconsistent discipline to workers. Auditor Mary Hull says the problems are especially bad for firefighters of color, women, and those who identify as LGBTQ+. Congress is considering a measure that would protect culturally and economically important rivers on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
June is National Rivers Month, and a diverse host of supporters are calling for greater protections of the Olympic Peninsula's rivers and landscapes. The Wild Olympics Wilderness and Wild and Scenic Rivers Act in Congress would protect more than 126,000 acres as wilderness and designate 19 rivers and their tributaries as wild and scenic. The legislation has received support from local elected officials, tribes, businesses, and conservation groups. Ashley Nicole Lewis owns Bad Ash Fishing on the Olympic Peninsula and is a member of the Quinault Nation.
Protecting these forests, protecting these watersheds are super important culturally because salmon and steelhead fishing really is the bedrock of my culture as an Indigenous woman and also as somebody who works in the ecotourism field.
She says these are some of the most unique and productive salmon and steelhead waterways in the country. Nicole Lewis says safeguarding these landscapes now, while they are still in good condition, is crucial. She notes that the measure will protect fishing, boating, and hunting without closing down access to any of these opportunities.
It protects the Olympic Peninsula's ancient forests, free-flowing rivers, and salmon streams for the future, but it also permanently protects some of the last healthy upstream salmon and steelhead habitats left on the peninsula.
Nicole Lewis says the bill has benefits for the region's endangered orcas as well, which need the salmon from the peninsula's rivers to survive. She says everyone has a reason to care about this.
From the point in which a salmon swims up the river, dies, brings nutrients from the ocean into the forest, creates healthy forests, which creates cleaner air, every point of this is important and connected to anything that we care about in the Northwest.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
As the California legislature approves its last budget bills today, health and immigration advocates are celebrating. That's because the budget includes funds to expend Medi-Cal to undocumented adults ages 26 through 49. As Suzanne Potter reports, California is taking a big step toward universal health care.
California is poised to become the first state in the nation to give health care to all income-eligible residents, regardless of their immigration status. The legislature is set to pass the final budget bills this week, which will be signed by Governor Gavin Newsom shortly thereafter. Cynthia Buisa with the California Immigrant Policy Center says this is the fulfillment of an almost decade-long push by the Health for All campaign.
This is very timely, but also long overdue, because for many, many years, many of our immigrant workers who have contributed tremendously to what makes California, California, have gone on without this very important safety net.
This budget deal represents a huge step toward universal health coverage and is expected to benefit about 700,000 people starting in 2024. Opponents cite the cost. The budget includes $625 million to cover the first 6 months of 2024 and allocates $2.1 billion per year after that. Beatriz Hernandez is an organizer with the California Immigrant Policy Center from the Central Valley. She says this will make a huge difference in people's quality of life.
This means that they will finally be able to get the health care to care for the chronic illnesses that they've been suffering for many years, and also be able to get the checkups that they need.
This deal marks the final push to expand Medi-Cal to all low-income Californians. In 2015, the state expanded Medi-Cal to include undocumented children. In 2020, the program grew to include young adults up to 26 years old. And this year, the program began to accept undocumented adults age 50 and older. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court in the case Vega versus Tecco has weakened the set of protections established by the landmark case Miranda versus Arizona. It's the more than 50-year-old precedent for the Miranda rights read to someone who's being arrested. As Edwin Vieira reports, this does not entirely invalidate the rights of people when police arrest them.
Another important U.S. Supreme Court ruling this month has been overshadowed by the controversy about overturning abortion rights. Legal experts say the court has weakened the rights of people who've been arrested in its 6-3 decision in the case Vega v. Tecco. At issue was a landmark 1966 decision on Miranda rights, the statement that police read to people as they're arrested. Vincent Bonventri, a distinguished professor of law at Albany Law School, says the high court is making a distinction between Miranda protections and the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination.
While an individual can sue under 1983 for a violation of his constitutional right against compelled self-incrimination, the court said that the individual cannot sue under 1983 for violation of Miranda rights because Miranda rights aren't constitutional rights.
The 1983 Bonventri refers to is Section 1983 of the Ku Klux Klan Act, an amendment to the 1871 law which allows people to file lawsuits if they feel their constitutional rights have been violated. The new ruling means in these cases, a person cannot sue law enforcement officials under federal civil rights law for Miranda warning violations. But Bonventri says New York's Court of Appeals, as well as other state courts, can protect Miranda rights more than the Supreme Court and without penalty. He doesn't think the Vega v. Tecco decision will be as major a change to the legal system as it seems, and points out that the court could have ruled differently.
The court did not have to rule this way. The court could have said, well, Miranda rights are important enough, and they are part of constitutional law, even though they are not the actual constitutional right, and therefore we want to protect them by allowing individuals to sue when their Miranda rights are violated.
The original 1966 case, Miranda versus Arizona, has for decades provided a safeguard for people against the right to self-incrimination through forced confessions. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, New York News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a KBOO News in-depth report on a rally for justice for Derek Clark. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather, mostly clear skies, low down at 56. Tomorrow's weather, clear to partly cloudy, a high of 81. Today in history, we look at two events that happened on this date, and we get some insight from historian and Ohio State University professor Chris Nichols. In 2008, India Pride March in Delhi. On this date, hundreds of gay rights supporters gathered in Delhi, marking the first time the city hosted a gay pride parade. So they demanded an end to discrimination against gay, lesbian, and trans people. So it was the largest display of gay pride in history. And tell me about how far we have come in the world on that issue.
Well, so I think on one hand, you could say we've seen a real sea change in public opinion, particularly in the US, but around the world. on gay rights broadly understood, the ability to, you know, choose your sex partners, to have unions, to come out, to be embraced by your community, whether it's the most local family, friends, and school, all the way up. But on the other hand, you know, I think you could make a reasonable case that the sorts of things that we're seeing right now, particularly these Supreme Court rulings are, and state level politics, such as, you know, suggesting that parents shouldn't let students identify as trans or go to certain kinds of events, this sort of vilification and as well as actual repercussions in terms of criminal law, suggests that the pendulum is swinging the other direction. You know, I'd like to say optimistically that we live in a more inclusive world than, you know, when that parade happened. But on the other hand, in some places, it probably feels like we've taken a turn back. I don't live in one of those places right now, but, you know, I will soon. And I think that's the reality of that is really hard to stomach for people who actually just sort of believe in a libertarian ethos of kind of live and let live, much less more, you know, liberal and interventionist or social democratic, where they think that the government should actively support those kinds of rights.
Yeah. And another thing that happened in history that I wanted to ask you about. In Hong Kong, the British flag was lowered for the last time on this date in 1997, the colonial flag of Hong Kong, before it was handed over to China. So it was kind of an end of an era of the colonial era where Britain basically owned everything or ran everything in the world.
I was there.
You were? Oh,
what was that like? That is the most historic event I've been an active participant in. Of course, I was not part of any of the government things. I was just a college student, but it was historic. Tons of people were there from the sort of British Empire, lots of Aussies and Kiwis and all those folks partying and celebrating and somewhat lamenting kind of an end of the British Empire. It was a moment of great sort of trepidation and anticipation by those in Hong Kong. So the big question was, you know, would they really be able to retain democracy, be this kind of bastion of the West and kind of a financial center for Asia, East Asia? So there was a lot of questions there. And then the Chinese government had been pushing for this and unification and a kind of one China principle, which they're continuing to push in terms of Taiwan. So there was real questions about whether or not Chinese military forces would suddenly emerge the day after. Lots of negotiations about that, and they did not. But as we've seen in recent years, you know, one of the ramifications is that now, you know, a full generation later, Chinese forces do come in, right? When there are protests there, we've seen, you know, serious clashes, and we've seen them kind of trying to cherry pick who runs Hong Kong. And so you've got pro-democracy forces there, and still, you might even argue, still pro-British and pro-Western in the sense that they long to go back to the era of just minding their own business with a little bit of British support, as in the 90s. So, you know, it's an interesting thing to think about these kinds of transfers in the moment, these historic moments that seem to be, you know, liberatory and emancipatory, and then the realities of the kind of ways that major powers can propel their own hegemonic force, right? China is just much more powerful than Hong Kong, and sure enough, those fears have been largely lived out and come to fruition.
Yeah, just ask Taiwan. Well, that's neat. Yeah, I love Hong Kong. It's a great, fun place to go.
Me too. So the parties for that were fantastic and amazing. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds wonderful. Immigration advocates criticize border policies after migrants die in a tractor trailer. The U.S. opens a permanent headquarters for our forces in Poland. And a House committee hears about growing housing inequity. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's the latest edition of 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I mean, they are moving too slow in terms of the promise of creating a more humane border and passing immigration reform.
Fernando Garcia, executive director of the Border Network for Human Rights, criticized the Biden administration's border policies after more than 50 migrants died in an abandoned tractor trailer without air conditioning. At the NATO summit in Madrid, President Biden announced a permanent headquarters for U.S. forces in Poland, where 10,000 troops are stationed, and new deployments of troops and weapons to Europe. He also met with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who praised U.S. efforts to partner with Turkey to help get grain out of Ukraine and Russia.
There are countries deprived of the grains, and we will open corridors and we will allow them to have access to the grains that they so need.
Officials testified before lawmakers on a plan to support non-citizen service members, deported veterans, and their family members to receive entitled benefits. Deborah Rogers of the Department of Homeland Security spoke about helping their families.
They call on us to do our best, to follow through, and to leave no one behind.
The U.S. Supreme Court Wednesday ruled states can prosecute non-Native Americans who commit crimes against Native Americans within indigenous reservations. Meanwhile, Justice Stephen Breyer retires from the Supreme Court Thursday after the court releases its final rulings of the term. Conservatives praised the court's recent decisions expanding religious rights in two rulings involving a religious school in Maine and a Seattle high school football coach. Managing attorney at the Liberty Justice Center, Daniel Sir.
This Supreme Court is the most protective of religious liberty that we perhaps have ever seen.
Liberal groups countered the court's decisions compromise the separation of church and state. Legal director of the group Freedom from Religion, Rebecca Margett.
What we saw in this last week was an enormous loss of religious liberty rights for individual taxpayers and young public school children who do not adhere to the majority faith.
Housing advocates testified on rising home prices in a virtual hearing before the House Financial Services Committee. Democratic North Carolina Representative Alma Adams noted the market's growing inequality.
In my city of Los Angeles, the Black home ownership rate was 34% in 2021, lower than it was in 1910.
Finally, some House lawmakers want Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to take additional and urgent action to combat anti-Semitism after incidents in the U.S. reached an all-time high. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A roundtable discussion of the Supreme Court's Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta case, new Navajo cops graduate from their academy, a Native nation takes back more than 1,000 acres from New York State, and in Louisiana, tribe leaders sign a bill to create an immersion school. Here's the latest national Native news.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The National Congress of American Indians and the Native American Rights Fund are hosting a virtual roundtable for tribal leaders to discuss potential impacts of the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling on Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta. The High Court Wednesday ruled 5-4 Oklahoma can prosecute non-Indians for crimes against Indians in Indian country. The decision is a reversal of the precedent set by the court in its 2020 landmark McGirt decision, which held states do not have authority. National Congress of American Indians President Fawn Sharp called the ruling an attack on tribal sovereignty. John Echohawk, executive director of the Native American Rights Fund, agrees, saying the unauthorized and unconsented intrusions on tribal sovereignty are antithetical to tribal sovereignty and tribal treaty rights. The Native organizations are continuing to analyze the decision, saying the consequences for tribes, the federal government, and states will take time to unravel. The Tribal Leaders Roundtable is scheduled to take place next week. The newest group of Navajo Nation police officers recently graduated from the tribe's training academy. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, they'll join a department tasked with patrolling the largest reservation in the United States.
10 men and women attended a ceremony in Crown Point, New Mexico last Saturday to receive their police badges. They make up the 57th Navajo Nation Police Training Academy class and will now work on the 27,000 square mile reservation that includes parts of northern Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. The 28-week training course that recruits undergo focuses on academics, crime scene management, de-escalation techniques, and several other areas of policing. Navajo Police Chief Daryl Noon attended the ceremony and said 32 people began the course last December. It comes as the Navajo Police Department has faced myriad challenges like officer retention and funding. A report last year called for several major reforms, including doubling the number of officers who patrol the vast reservation in order to improve public safety. Navajo President Jonathan Nez, who also attended the graduation, said the tribe has raised police salaries in order to retain officers and has also created a new enforcement program to fight drug use and sales, as well as bootlegging and violent crimes. Nez also said the force has begun incorporating traditional Navajo beliefs into how it addresses substance abuse, suicide, missing and murdered indigenous people, and other persistent issues that officers commonly face on the reservation. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heiches in Flagstaff.
The Onondaga Nation, the state of New York, and the U.S. Interior Department announced Wednesday an agreement to return more than 1,000 acres of ancestral land back to the tribal nation. The agreement stems from a 2018 settlement with the company Honeywell. It directs the company to transfer the land in central New York's Tule Valley to the nation. It's said to be one of the largest returns of land by any state to a tribe. Plans are to restore and manage the area, which includes wetlands, forests, floodplains, and fields. The Pointe Aux Chênes tribe in Louisiana is working to create a culturally reflective French immersion school. Last week, tribal and state leaders took part in a ceremonial signing of a bill which creates the school. In recent years, the tribe has made it a priority to maintain the Indian French language after previous efforts to establish an immersion school failed. The tribe is focused on creating a school to incorporate the local dialects of Indian French and Cajun French into the curriculum. The bill passed the legislature without opposition. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 30th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Suzanne Potter, Eric Tegadop, and Edwin Vieira. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs